The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this November 2014 Sesshin here at Mountain Gate, which will end the day before Thanksgiving. And perhaps we should have a theme of Thanksgiving and gratitude here, but at the moment, what I'm going to do today is share some of Robert Aiken's teachings from a book called A Zen Wave, Basho's Haiku and Zen. Robert Aiken was quite fond of haiku, and in fact, I think that was how he ended up in Japan and ended up as well in a prisoner of war camp under the Japanese in the Second World War. He was a student of R.H. Blythe, I believe. And I don't know if he met Blythe in the... I think he met Blythe in the prisoner of war camp. At any rate, the two of them shared a deep love of both Zen and haiku. And Robert Aiken made a career of both of those. He says in the foreword something very, very, very important for Zen students. I'd like to share that with you right now. Operating superficially, the mind is random in its activity and stale in its insights and images. However, with practice and experience, the mind is freed from the skull, and the fresh and new can appear as though for the first time. It becomes clear that the universe and its beings are a complementarity of empty infinity, intimate interrelationships, and a total uniqueness of each and every being. This fundamental complementarity is the theme of Zen, and masters have played with its facets and interactions in dialogues and sermons down through the ages. Anyone who finds this kind of emancipation from the skull, at least momentarily, is more or less freed from getting and spending, depending on factors of talent, influence, and heritage. Let me read this again because it's really quite important. Operating superficially, which is how in modern society most of us operate. We assume, it's almost a cultural assumption, that the mind is located in the brain, that it has something to do with the brain, although nobody's quite figured out how. But actually, in terms of Zen, the mind's not limited to any one place or time. Operating superficially, the mind is random in its activity and stale in its insights and images. If we stop and listen to the yada yada that's going on in our minds, it's fragments of talk, bits and pieces of music, a few random comments. It's almost as if this so-called mind has kind of gone out on its own and not quite figured out how to work. Whereas how we can really experience life is very different. And Aiken uses that to express some of the poetry of Basho. He talks about Basho. Basho, by the way, means bananas. Not in the sense of being nuts, but literally banana plants. And the man who was Basho was born into a family of samurai and worked as a page in a samurai castle until he was in his 20s at least. And he and the head of the person who was the top guy were basically about the same age, and so they kind of grew up together and they were best friends, and they did a lot of poetry together. They apparently both shared a love of poetry, and unfortunately the young man died young, at which point Basho, who was not yet being called Basho, left the services of the master and started wandering, doing pilgrimage, writing poetry. And my, his most famous poem is this. Old pond, frog jumps in, kersplash. The technical writing in words of that last line is sound of water. So he wasn't trying to imitate a sound of water, he was expressing the sound of water. When we experience life fully, that's what we do. We experience whatever is in front of us. The fly buzzing on the window pane. The warmth of the sun hitting our face. The hum of the humidifier here in the Zendo. And this is important. If we're truly to experience life fully, we need to pay attention, serious, complete attention. Many, many centuries ago, a monk asked a master in China, what is the most important thing in Zen practice? And the master picked up his brush and wrote, attention. The monk said, what do you mean attention? The master wrote it again, attention. And he said again, what do you mean by attention? And the master said, attention means attention. When we are told to pay attention, most of us have some idea about it, but we're often multitasking at the same time. We're daydreaming about something or thinking about something else as we're doing whatever we're supposedly paying attention to. And in so doing, we miss a wondrous opportunity in our life. When we are able to truly pay attention, so close attention that there's nobody paying attention, there's only the thing unfolding, the experience unfolding, it becomes deeply fulfilling. Moreover, we're not sitting there with an inner commentary about ourselves, judging. Oh, I should have done it this way. Oh, I'm so stupid. Why didn't I think to whatever? Etc., etc., etc. We have a constant running dialogue about ourselves. No wonder we're depressed. No wonder we're frustrated. No wonder we're feeling like life is not what we'd like it to be. Old pond. Frog jumps in. Whew! Can we be that attentive? Aiken considers that a turning point in Basho's life. By the way, he got the name because as he became well known for his haiku, a patron let him have the use of a cottage, outside of which were a lot of banana plants, apparently. And the cottage was called Basho-an, which means the Basho, the the Banana Hermitage. And over time, because he lived there, Basho became known as Basho. He wrote an earlier poem in which he talks about a crow sitting on a withered branch in autumn. And Aiken comments on that. He feels it wasn't very free. Moreover, he feels it expressed what in Zen is considered a rather dangerous mind state, is what Hakuin railed against, quiet sitting. The cave of dead sitting, where we seek out a quiet place in our mind, a quiet mind state, and we kind of hang there. And it feels nice, feels comfortable, feels calm and peaceful, but it's not awakening. And in fact, if we hang out there, we're not going to get to awakening. Rather, we want to experience our practice as Basho experienced that frog jumping into the old pond, fully present, no matter what it is. And, of course, through our practice, lots of things are going to come up, some of them pleasant and some of them not quite so pleasant, and some of which we would rather not have experienced at all. But our practice is about exploring this mind and finding the source of it and becoming free of these random musings and fractured fragments of speech and music so that we can truly live. Because when we allow ourselves to be completely one with whatever is there in each moment, seeking out the source. Who is it that's feeling this? Where is this coming from? How is it arising? Not as an intellectual exercise, but as a wordless search. A search for the path back to your true home. Then if something difficult comes up, and we allow ourselves to become truly one with it, there is a space around us so that we don't need to react, project out our feelings about whatever it is that's come up. It can dissolve, and we can become free of it in that moment. This is pretty tremendous. The man who in Japanese is called Kyogen was a Chinese monk who had struggled with his practice, struggled a great deal with his practice, and finally decided that he wasn't cut out for the monastery, that he really didn't have what it took to do the practice to the depth that was really asked for in a monastery. And so he went away, and he decided that at least if he couldn't be a true monk, at least he could take care of the grave of someone who had been of high status in the past. And I had always heard that it was another master, but apparently it wasn't somebody. It was somebody of high status, but they weren't a Buddhist master. And this koan that he'd been given, show me your face before your parents were born, which was the source of his pain, he continued chewing on it. All the time he was taking care of that gravesite, sweeping every day, making the area neat and clean, offering incense, flowers, whatever else, to the grave,
honoring the deceased. And then one day, when he was deep in samadhi, totally at one with the sweeping, so much at one with the sweeping that there was nobody sweeping, suddenly a stone flew up and hit a piece of bamboo. Tunk! And all of a sudden, Kyogen's mind broke open. And he had an awakening experience. Because he was so totally present and had been so totally present, chewing on that koan, that Kyogen had disappeared. And so there was room for awakening to happen. This is an important aspect of our practice. In the West, particularly in America, we are taught to value ourselves in current society at the expense of others, even. Back in the 1970s, there's a series of books that came out teaching people how to survive in the corporate world, survive and thrive in the corporate world. But unfortunately, it was sort of surviving and thriving by climbing in the backs and the heads of other people. Look out for number one was the first title. Another one was How to Survive in the Corporate Jungle. Nothing about being kind and understanding. Nothing about being totally present and doing a good job of your work. It's how you can put yourself forward first, even at the expense of your fellow employees. There was a paradigm shift in America at that time. And unfortunately, it has continued in large part in many parts of our culture, where each person is an island to himself or herself, an island of self-importance. No wonder we have wars. No wonder we have murders. No wonder we have identity theft. No wonder we have pain and suffering. The way out, as Kapler-Rushi always used to say, the way in is the way out. To dive inward, to explore our own mind, to search, to pay utter attention, not to sweep anything under the carpet, to be brave and open to the whole catastrophe. And in the process, to become free. To free the mind from the skull, as Robert Aitken puts it. So that we can truly be free. It's our birthright. It's why we come to practice. It's why we were born. And we can do it. It takes time and effort. We have to swim upstream against a current of long-standing habit patterns in the beginning. But just as even a giant aircraft carrier can be turned around, it can be stopped and it can be turned around. It takes 5 miles, apparently, before it can stop, and 5 more miles before it can actually turn around and head in the opposite direction, but it can do both of those things. And so can we. No matter how conditioned we are, we have the capacity for freedom from it built in. And here we are fortunate enough to have the practice, this powerful, incredibly powerful practice of the extended out breath, and also working with the need to know, the curiosity, a search for a true home, the koans. You just need to keep at it. Keep at it. When we find our minds wandering, to bring them back to the focus. This is the gift of the extended out-breath. We cannot wander in our minds at the same time we are extending that breath out if we're doing it properly. It's impossible. We cannot entertain the yada yada of our discursive intellect if we're extending the out-breath in the way it's meant to be extended. It's impossible. It requires focus, and that requires letting go of everything else. This is the gift of this practice. And when it's coupled with our need to become free, our need to return to our true home, our need to understand what life is about, what death is about, it's dynamite. It's an incredible practice. An incredible freeing practice. And then Robert Aitken adds another facet to this. He says, we know from our own practice and from our reading in the psychology of religion that suffering precedes personal liberation. And knowledge of this offers some comfort in the difficulties of work on our first koan. R.H. Blythe said to me in one of our first conversations, there is no satori without tears. And then Aitken quotes Basho. I am resolved to bleach on the moors. My body is pierced by the wind. And in an earlier poem, he writes, exhausted, seeking an inn, and then suddenly discovers wisteria flowers. Exhausted, seeking an inn. Wisteria flowers. Apparently in his journal, Basho wrote, most of the things I had brought from my journey turned out to be impediments, and I had thrown them away. However, I still carried my paper rope, my straw raincoat, inkstone, brush, paper, lunchbox, and other things on my back. Quite a load for me. More and more, my legs grew weaker and my body lost strength, making wretched progress. With knees trembling, I carried on as best I could, but I was utterly weary. Exhausted, seeking an inn. Wisteria flowers. But then there is the poem. Without the piercing cold that bites into the bones. How could the plum blossoms regale me with their piercing fragrance? Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest master of note, said, there's two kinds of suffering. There's long-term suffering and there's short-term suffering. Short-term suffering is the suffering we go through as we do our practice in Buddhism. Long-term suffering is the suffering we experience if we don't. That sounds a little grim. There's plenty of moments of joy in practice, plenty of moments of ease in practice, but you have to be prepared for the darkness as well, to Tony Parker once told me, I only met one person who didn't come to Zen out of pain. And she added, and it only took him 6 months to uncover it. To walk right in, bravely, opening to the physical experience of that pain, tasting it deeply, staying present with its energy, ignoring the impulse to escape into thought. This is how we work with that pain. And we put that anguish into the practice. It helps us take the breath out further. It helps the questioning to go deeper. It's a gift, really. It's truly a gift.
I am resolved to bleach on the moors. My body is pierced by the wind. And he did. He died in his early 50s on pilgrimage. But he's remembered. He's remembered today. And then there's one more thing that Haken brings up. It's just a little bit off target. Well, not off target. Off subject to a certain degree. He quotes a story about the head cook in a monastery. At the monastery Fugai Ikkun, ceremonies delayed preparation of the noon meal one day, and the cook had to take up his sickle and hurriedly gather vegetables from the garden. In his haste, he lopped off part of a snake, but unaware that he'd done so, he threw it into the soup pot with the vegetables. At the meal, the monks thought they'd never tasted such delicious soup, but the master himself found something remarkable in his bowl. Summoning the cook, he held up the head of the snake and demanded, "What is this?" The cook took the morsel, saying, "Oh, thank you, Roshi," and immediately ate it. And it's pointed out that there are a lot of reactions that Tenzo could have had, although, to be honest, Tenzo, a person isn't normally set into the position of Tenzo of a monastery until they have had long years of practice under their belt, and they have let go a lot of stuff. And obviously this cook had as well. Instead of, I really didn't have enough time to get the meal on, so I was just in such a rush in the garden that I must have done that by mistake. I'm so sorry. No, instead he just popped it up in his mouth and he said, "Oh, thank you." No embarrassment. No wish to disappear. No litany of excuses. Just, "Oh, thank you." I leave you with that. A mark of a person who has let go a great deal. I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.